Welcome to the Department of Homeland Security, the officially unofficial podcast for the boys on Amazon streaming Prime thing. I'm Jim.
I'm Heron.
And today we're talking about season 2, episode 7, Butcher, Baker, Candlestick Maker. Aaron, what do you think of this episode?
You know, it's not quite Homelander mowing down everybody at a protest with his heat visions. But I did quite like how the storyline kind of got exploded, pardon my pun, mm-hmm. with the congressional testifying scene.
Yeah.
Boy, there's something about it just illustrates how like the concept of these supers kind of break the justice system. You know, they're like mafia bosses, only there are no human limitations to them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And how terrifying that could be, and how hard it is to bring anyone to kind of justice when you're dealing with that. And there's also, like, maybe a question, like, you know, how much, like, Homelander and Stormfront are into, because they're front and center and kind of looking around bewildered. But no, I really like this episode. It has me wondering how the hell can they pull this out of any kind of nosedive in just one episode to go, because it just seems like it's so Empire Strikes Back. Our heroes are just getting mm-hmm. their ass kicked every other episode. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, no, I thought it was awesome too. The question, like that idea of, oh, how can you bring any, you know, evil soup to justice? Is one that I think doesn't have a good answer and almost can't have a good answer, because our court is, you know, at its best moments focused on the idea of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that someone is committing crimes, has done something bad. How do you do that when there's no physical evidence? Like, I don't know who's popping heads here. I want to say that maybe it's Cindy that we saw at Sage Grove last episode. Right. How do you prove that she has that power, A? And then B, how do you prove that she used that power in that situation and there isn't another soup out there who did it, right? Like, the evidence there would be impossibly hard to gather, and the case would be impossibly hard to prove, I would think. It's not like Homelander where he lasers somebody and you can have it on camera, right?
Right. No, it's one of those things where, like, Mandy... This justice system where it's presumption of innocence and requiring, you know, like airtight testimony and evidence, like, really falls apart, kind of like in the same way it does. I mean, this is The Godfather, like, where you find out that, like, you know, he's threatened every single member of a jury, you know, or sure. paid them all $10,000 to look the same way, or like. And I think that's what's interesting is, like, to the extent that you can analogize this unrestricted power, this is essentially, like, Vought is a stand-in for any multinational corporation that wants to trample on an individual's rights, because none of us really have the means to go after and punish them in any kind of meaningful way. Like, even when, yeah. you know, oil company gets slapped with a $50 billion fine because they polluted the Gulf, what does that even mean to them?
It means, like, this year isn't going to be quite as profitable.
Yeah, Q3 is going to be a little bit disappointing for shareholders, and it's going to hurt our stock price a little bit. Yeah. And, like, even if you can strike at their heart, they're literally immortal beings.
Yeah.
Like, corporations are immortal entities that, you know, have protections far beyond what people... I mean, I think that's the Rosetta Stone. That's kind of, like, what you're supposed to understand what they're doing. But, yeah, like, they don't pop heads. It's just, like, you can't run them out of money. And as long as they have money, they can mount a legal defense.
And if you manage to do something to strike, you know, at the heart and kill them, they can just reform as something else, right? They're this monstrous, they're like a blob, right, that will absorb this blow and just sort of morph around the thing that hit them and become something else. It's, yeah, how do you deal with that kind of a thing? And now, how do you deal with it when it's making superheroes, superpowered beings?
Yeah, it's like we did a review for Wolf of Wall Street this week on Wednesday, and it's the same kind of thing. It's like, even when you do catch these criminals and bring them to some kind of justice, it's a miscarriage. Like, oh, it's a 12 10 months at Club Fed,
right?
You know, and that's when you have a working Justice Department that actually is standing up for the people and prosecuting things in a fair and just manner. So
that's by no means guaranteed.
Right. So I feel like a lot of these episodes, like they're about these silly morality plays about superheroes. But holy shit, they do feel very relevant, and they're very good at capturing how helpless you feel in front of these large entities as an individual.
And so, I'll say also another aspect of this episode that really hit me was the stuff that's happening with the church. Goddamn, like they get that part of this, like everything they're saying about, you know, about Eagle in this episode is right on the money, as far as I can tell, from my experience with cults and churches.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, it's all over the top and silly in its way, but also it's striking like right at the heart of what it feels like to be in a cult, and it, from multiple angles too, right? It's like you've got the Deep, who is deep into it, and you've got A-Train, who's kind of like on the fringe, still with his eyebrows raised, going, is this a thing that, you know, everybody is cool with?
He's also being love bombed for the first time in a while. He feels like an odd man out by the rest of society and by his other in group. So he's,
yeah,
you know, at risk to being victimized by a cult like this.
For sure. So yeah, I really enjoyed this episode quite a bit.
Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
All right, we start off with kind of a montage of this guy who is, let's call him a super fan. It seems like he's got, you know, the posters on the walls, and he's very much into the Seven and the Supes. Mm-hmm. And he's hearing all this stuff on the news about Supes day after day, and about super terrorists and just the shit going on with him. And he eventually suspects some guy at the corner store of being a Supe. A super terrorist, actually, I think, and mm-hmm. goes and actually kills him with a gun. Turns out he's not a Supe. He's just a regular dude, and this guy has killed a guy.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really frightening portrait of someone being radicalized by,
yep.
You know, highly charged coverage of hyper-specific things. And this is something we're seeing on a daily basis. Like, people are getting radicalized. They're not coming to conclusions based on any kind of like serious journalism or analysis of statistics. It's like, oh, I just watched 3 dozen videos of immigrants beating people up, and now I've decided that my country has an immigrant problem that has to be solved right now. And there's a lot of things. Like, there's a documentary that came out a couple of years ago called The Brainwashing of My Dad, where someone is looking at how, like, you know, Fox and like Sinclair, One American News Network have been steadily radicalizing, especially older generations of Americans. But, you know, what they're doing, like with mainstream media, a lot of places like and are happening in the shadowy parts of like Twitch and YouTube, where you can just, you know, instead of like having to wait for a particular host to come around at 8 p.m. segment to tell you how much you can hate people, you can just watch that shit all the time.
Sure.
You know, if mainline. You can just mainline it, just like, you know, forget the commercials, forget the actual news, forget the press conferences, just watch black and brown people tearing shit up all the time.
You are going to have to sit through a couple of like survival bucket internal sure, ads,
yeah,
right? Like,
yeah, they have some vitamins, some nootropics. Yeah, yeah.
They have the Alex Jones analog in there, which I appreciated. You can tell he's got that raspy shitbag voice.
It's kind of like I thought it was like a like splitting the difference between Alex Jones and Rush Limbaugh, like the sure. old guard passing the torch to the new guard of Blowhard. Yeah. But no, I mean this shit and the other thing, like just to cover all my bases, this can happen to left leaning people just as easily. I didn't get the
impression problem that this guy was like right or left. I thought he was just a dude who is isolated. I think that's the biggest thing they're trying to make here is this is all he's hearing. And like he puts in his headphones, he walks past people during the day, he doesn't talk to anyone. That's it.
He smiles at women hoping they'll smile back, but he, you know, that he is he willing to do any? Yeah, there's a lot of like they do so much cultural commentary in this first 3 or 4 minutes, but I do feel like there's some people that might feel smug that couldn't happen to them. And I'm just telling you, it's not as big a problem right now because we don't have people running for Congress like the way, you know, that they're running on like Eat the Rich, Guillotine, Wall Street platform. But another 10 years, it might happen. And that's going to be you're at risk to be victimized and radicalized on either end of the political spectrum if you let it happen to yourself. If you, again, abandon critical consensus of experts and statistical analysis in favor of hyper individualized anecdotal data, you know? Yeah. It's scary. It's scary because it turns this person who's like just a dude, like you said, into, I don't know. Like the other thing is like, it's just a scene. It's as a vignette. Like what happens to this guy? It's obviously it becomes, it's a background thing for the rest episode. You hear like Stormfront and Homelander talking about, oh, sure, we disavow this act of this lone wolf, but also the broad, it doesn't affect our broader, and that, you know, you see that kind of stuff too when you have a shooting of a mosque or a temple or a black church. It's always a lone wolf, but, you know.
Yeah, but then you have a couple people breaking windows during a protest, and it's suddenly the entirety
the entirety of a fucking movement.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
It's scary. This scene's like this is as much fucked up shit that happens in The Boys. These opening scenes are amongst the scariest as far as like happening in real life, I think.
Yeah. So the next scene is the forces of good uniting. It's The Boys, it's Lamplighter, it's Grace, and the anti-soup congresswoman who needs some protection. They need to know more about why they're conducting these experiments at Sage Grove before they take their shot, and Grace knows where they can get some info. She doesn't say anything about where that is, though. And we see Butcher getting a call from a strange number.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also Butcher not being happy with the way they're prosecuting this war. You know, he's like, you get the cunt and you squeeze him till he gives up the next cunt and then you kill him,
yeah.
You know? And it's funny because the colonel's right. It's like, this is just a prescription for a cycle of unending escalating violence.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, going through look what happens with going through the official channels. This show's kind of nihilist, right?
Yeah, what's the recourse here?
Yeah, I'm waiting for like, okay, what is the actual answer? Civil war among superheroes with us on the sidelines. That's not a satisfying answer, but it seems to be where the show is going.
It's almost the inevitable conclusion here because I don't think there's any force that can stop the soups other than soups.
Yeah. Yeah, and no one's willing to like take a stand and ratchet down the rhetoric. Maybe, you know, maybe you could have someone like Storm or Starlight, but shit, she's just been turned into a super terrorist. So
sure.
There you go. And, you know, Congressman Newman is support, like, you know, she's now like Homelander's been kind of calling her out and Stormfront has. And now she's going to be like, how soon is it, you know, when is she going to be targeted? Did she make it out of that room with her head intact? I think she did.
She does. Yeah. Grace shuffles her off out of the room.
I thought so.
Which we'll talk about it. And maybe gives us some indication as to who's doing this. You know, we've speculated about who might be doing this, but we'll get there.
Inject Newman with Compound V. It's the only answer.
There you go.
Inject Newman and all of the House Judiciary Oversight Committees. They all need Compound V immediately.
She'll probably get like the ability to, I don't know, grow her fingernails really long on command. I have no idea.
Sure. Adamantium nails. Yep.
No, just long nails. Just regular just human long nails. Yeah. They'll be all curly.
It'll be real gross. She has the superpower of setting the new Guinness Book of World Records for longest fingernails.
Hell yeah. That's the thing. It seems like such a crapshoot when you make a superhero, right? This way.
Yeah.
It's just they get the power they get. And
going to get a dick tentacle or are you going to get a Homelander, you know?
Yep. All right. Annie's mother meets her for coffee to mend things between them. Unfortunately, she's made a big mistake. She called ahead to Vought to clear some time off for Annie so they could go away. And, of course, Vought is after her, and they bust into the coffee shop and capture her. This confirms, right? We were wondering, okay, had she officially flipped sides? Is taking this tracking device out going to be the stamp on that? And yes, in fact, it is.
Yeah, it's seen as a provocation by Vought, and but I audibly gasped when she started talking this mess about pre-clearing this going away trip with Vought. I'm like, oh, and just as soon as I was like, but that means here comes Black Noir busting through like the Kool-Aid man. Did you recognize Gas? Starlight's
Gas? Go ahead. Yeah, Gas doesn't do anything to her. Like they hit her. They hit the entire restaurant with gas canisters, and her mom passes out immediately.
Yeah, instantly. Yeah, yeah.
And she's there, like, looking around like nothing's happening, hardly.
These soups have some kind of, like, above-average protection against a broad variety of things. But then you got Lamplighter can burn himself to death. That seems ridiculous.
Right.
So, they're all over the map. And the Gecko, you know, he's not invulnerable, but he can regenerate really quickly.
It seems like we're just going to have to track this stuff individually by soup from what we see actually on screen and not infer too much other than maybe like strength and general resistance to physical damage.
It does seem like if you make it to the 7, you should be well nigh invulnerable, but then Lamplighter.
Right, right.
You know,
he wasn't the 7, like, but he's not.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe only he can light himself on fire. I don't know.
Yeah.
But did you recognize that her? We've seen Starlight's mother a couple times, but this is the first time I put two and two together and realized that she's one of the lesser known Cusack siblings, Anne Cusack.
Yes.
Who also, last time I saw her, was Chuck's wife in Better Call Saul.
Right, right.
Yeah. So it's nice seeing her again. I always enjoy when she shows up.
Yeah, she's great.
Not sure. Is she going to be a boy now? Because she's. She's as wanted as Starlight, probably. Vought had no problem throwing her into the super detention room.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it. They take her to the boys' HQ after this, right?
Yeah, got to.
And Annie, in this scene, is kind of lamenting the fact that the bad guys never get punished, which is kind of something we talked about up front. And that kind of, that makes everything that they do pointless. Because, you know, if the good guys are going to do good and it's just going to be nullified by the bad guys, what's the point?
It's a really great speech by the Colonel later on in the episode where she talks about that like, you know, sometimes you just have to let go. You know, if you continue a particular mission, it's going to lead you, you're going to not get the things you want. You're going to lose everything.
Yeah.
And like I said, as I said, the show feels at this point in its current Empire Strikes Back mode, it feels very nihilist. Like, shit, just try to live the best life you can in this shithole, because trying to actually do something about it is going to get you killed.
Sure. All right, next up is Frenchie being tasked with keeping the Congresswoman safe. Huey's tasked with babysitting Lamplighter, and Butcher gets a call from his mom, who says his father's dead, and he agrees to see her.
Mm-hmm. The super porn.
What is Grace calling Frenchie? Is it Serge? Like,
I didn't like a, like I a Sergei didn't pick that
kind
up.
Of thing, Serge.
I thought she made reference to Sarajevo, like some kind of like hand waving to some black ops they had done in Europe a long time ago. I didn't hear her like call him a pet name or something, but I could
Noah, his, I assumed his real name, like Frenchie is obviously not his real name, right? Yeah. It's his pet name, but like,
sure.
I thought maybe she was using his real name and I didn't pick up what it exactly was. I think it's maybe Serge.
Could be. She could be talking about the Serbs in Sarajevo.
Sure, why not? I do like that at the end she says no abandoning your post this time. It's like, okay, she remembers the history that they've got here, right? But also she's trusting him again.
Yeah, and it's like, because I thought it's like, is this a dig? But Frenchie certainly didn't take it as that. He took it as kind of like a vote of confidence, like, you know, I'm telling you not to, but also it should go without saying, but I'm saying just to point out that I'm trusting you with the exact same mission. Except for now, the stakes are even higher. Like, it's not just like, you know, me losing my grandkids. It's like, you know, the death of democracy kind of thing.
Yeah. It does make me wonder, are we going to have something where Kimiko goes rogue? Maybe, like, goes in to try and take out Stormfront or something, and Frenchie's supposed to be with her monitoring the Congresswoman, and then he's got to go off, and he's got to make a choice between his mission and Kimiko. I don't know if I want to see that.
From a storytelling presentation, that's not a story arc. That's a treadmill.
Yeah,
unless he makes the
other decision, right? Unless he decides to stay on mission and then Kimiko suffers as a result.
But maybe they subvert it and he shows the futility of trying to change yourself or your circumstances. You know, how fucking nihilist do they want to get in this show?
Sure. And this scene also is this a scene where we are introduced to the seven themed porn? Oh no, I think it's later.
It is like, yeah, you see someone with the deep, a fake deep with an inflatable porpoise standing in front of standing in a kiddie pool with a big fat ass in the foreground. Yeah. So it's an introduction, but they do a lot more with the theme later on for sure.
They sure do. Holy shit. All right, Annie wakes up in a super proof room and begs to be let out. Just that's a very quick scene.
Yeah, do you think that these super rooms are customized to the person? Because
not completely.
They got bioluminescent lighting, it seems. Like they're like lighting with glow sticks, which seems like it's purpose built for anti-Annie, but like, hell, there could be a super that gets energy from bioluminescence and now you're fucked. Like,
well, and also, like, it's this question of, like, how do Annie's powers work, really? Because they use electronic security locks on all these doors. Are you telling me that she has to be able to actually see the energy in order to pull from it?
Maybe it's insulated somehow. Like, you know, like, is her powers defeated by just insulation, you know?
But it can't be 100% custom tailored for Annie, because later she's let out by the security lights that come on, you know, the light backups or whatever. So clearly they didn't have this cell just for her, or they would have not had those in there.
Yeah, no, I did feel like this is they just established it's a super proof room. It's 6 foot steel, and they even said like mostly super proof. Like you know, you're not gonna understand that like you could lock Homelander in there and everything would be cool, but
right.
They can't even lock Annie in
once she gets her powers, right?
Right. Like 6 foot steel is great, but you still got like a 1-inch thick steel door holding the whole thing together.
Right. Yeah. The weakest link.
Mm-hmm.
So then Huey's watching seven themed porn with Lamplighter. He compares himself. Well, okay. Lamplighter compares him to a cuck first, and then he compares himself to that. But then Lamplighter goes one step further, says he's not even that good. He's a cuck fluffer. It's a hilarious scene filled with seven themed porn tributes and just like, yeah, it's good.
So if you don't know, you know, cuck porn is shortened from cuckold, which is an old timey word for committing adultery on someone without their noticing. Like, if you were to sleep with your friend's wife and he doesn't know about it, then you would be cuckolding him.
I just assume. I'm so fucked up. I have this strange relationship with the internet. I just assume that everyone knows what this is. But yes, go ahead and explain.
No, I figure that, like, yeah, because this is like, this is stuff that's just, this has been the internet kind of like lingo that's just starting to come out into the mainstream. The modern usage of cucking is there's a fetish where, you know, you might like to see your partner. There's this cuckold, which is the male version, and a cuck queen, which is the female version, that you enjoy seeing. Like, it's part of like humiliation. Fetish where, you know, like, you enjoy seeing your wife plowed by a man that's more endowed than you. And a lot of times there's a racial component that, like, you want to juice it up. It's a black man, you know, having sex with a white man's wife who's white. So that is popular in America, and like, Pornhub's done studies where it's popular in certain segments of America. Like, it tends to be more popular in South and the Midwest than it is in the coasts. Draw your own conclusions. It is a thing. I don't get it, but it is definitely a thing. And now the other thing is a fluffer. Do you know what a fluffer is, Jim?
Typically on a porn set, you'll have various means of keeping the actors in character, let's say. Especially the male actors. And a fluffer is someone who is in charge of that.
I've heard that that's kind of gone the way of the dodo with the invention of Viagra. Sure. That you don't have, like, on staff fluffers.
Yeah.
That's what's, so if you're what's worse than a cuck fluffer, or what's worse than a cuck is a cuck fluffer.
Yeah.
There you go. There's your porn education for the day. Next week we'll talk about how Pornhub gets around incest porn laws by calling everyone stepbrother, you know?
All right. Yeah, let's do
the
it.
The more you porn know.
Let's move on to...
Can we get a rainbow? Can we get a star shitting a rainbow coming across the screen here, Jim?
Next up, Homelander and Stormfront speak at a rally and claim they need to make more domestic soups. They also claim that Starlight was a mole for the people who murdered Translucent. Huey sees it on the news and he springs into action. Lamplighter tells him where Annie is probably being held, which is Vought Tower, and Huey asks for his help to bust her out.
Yeah. Is this rally? I mean, I kept on thinking when I was watching, is this rally like too heavy-handed, too on the nose? But like, it does feel that we are moving towards a post-fact society, and you can whatever the hell you want in an arena such as this, and no one really stops and is like, well, hey, wait a minute now.
These people are completely shameless. They will say absolutely anything that benefits them in the moment. You know, even their own words be damned, their own previous words. Like, it doesn't matter. It literally doesn't matter what they say or what they do.
The things you hold dear, it's like there aren't these shared values anymore. It's like agendas that both that sides have, and whatever you do in the furtherance of your agenda is okay, and the other side hates it, but that's okay because that's their, it's not because of any moral standing, it's just because they're pissed that you're able to get something done and they can't.
It's not even an ideological war anymore, it's simply it's a culture war. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. It's like, just how, like, how I hate you because you're you, and I'm with this person because they're with me. That's it.
Right. And if whoever has the most people on their side is going to win. Hopefully.
Yeah, we'll see. So there is also some more soup porn in this episode, or in this season. And I wasn't sure what it was. Like, okay, clearly it's a gay gangbang, it seems like it. The guy's asking for seven cocks in him at the same time. Who is this soup supposed to be, though? It's not Homelander, right? He's got red boots and a red cape, but it's an all red cape?
I don't know. I really don't know if it's supposed to be... if it's supposed to be an actual... because, like, they're using their actual names. Like, Starlight pulls an A-train, you know?
Right.
But I thought some of them also were kind of like the off, kind of like, you know, when they broke into the costume store, you had the official seven costumes, but then you also had the ones who were just, you know, like Home Ranger, you know? I wonder if, you know, Homelander's cool with like being starring in cuck porn where he's cucking some dude, but if he's a gay guy trying to get the seven that ran up his ass,
he wouldn't.
He's like, nah, you can't. He'll go and burn your face off. So no. They do a home ranger type of person.
So I looked in the credits because they have some of these characters listed in the credits.
Shit, yeah.
The Homelander analog in this porn video is called Home Banger. And you might have to explain this one as well. I don't know, but there's a character called Snowflake Cuck. And there's also a character called Porn Jack from Jupiter. And I'm not sure if this is an Easter egg, a comic spoiler or what, but Jack from Jupiter is apparently in the comics. And I tried not to read too much into it because I didn't want to know too much.
Yeah, but he's on the boys' wiki and it's spoiler palooza.
But I don't know what Jack from Jupiter looks like. I'm thinking maybe this is the guy that's in this scene.
Could be.
Because yeah, I'm with you. I don't think Homelander would like would look too kindly on the director that made him take seven cocks in his ass.
No.
But what do I know?
Yeah.
So Butcher shows up at his mom's house, but it's a setup to get Butcher to talk with his father. We find out that Lenny killed himself because he couldn't handle his father's abuse or something along those lines. There was some flashpoint moment, but I'm not quite sure. Maybe you can talk about it here in a second. His father's not sorry for it, claiming that Butcher, everything he did made Butcher stronger. And Butcher chokes him, but eventually lets him go and storms off.
I was delighted by these two cameos. First up, you have Leslie Nichol, who is Mrs. Pattimore, the cook from Downton Abbey, as Butcher's mom, which I thought was spot on. And then John fucking Noble, Denethor from Lord of the Rings, who crushes that role as this maniacal, cold, terrible father. He's just so good at being this. You can definitely see him being warm and affable, and he has a little bit of that as Denethor in Lord of the Rings, but he's also just fucking diabolical to rip Billy Butcher off. I do think they're setting up something of a little mystery, and I don't know how much more I need to know about Lenny, but they want me to, where it's clear that Butcher, that Billy blames his dad for what happened to Lenny, right?
Yeah.
But then his father says something like, you know, when he put the gun in his mouth, you took off the SAS, the Secret Air Service. You're the one that abandoned him. And I'm like, so did his brother make a suicide attempt that was foiled? And then Billy fled to the special forces to get away from that. And then his brother actually killed himself. Like, what is because there's a difference of opinion of who's responsible.
It's a good question. I'm not quite sure.
Because what does his dad mean? Like, well, if he stuck his gun in his mouth and blew his brains out and then went to the special forces, like, how is that abandoning your brother in any fucking, like, abandoning your family maybe? But he said, you're the one that abandoned him. So
yeah,
I feel like there might be a little bit more to the story that's interesting only insofar as us understanding his relationship with Huey, right?
Is he trying to say, like, a guy who cared for his brother, once his brother killed himself, would come back and hunt down the monster who killed him? Almost saying, like, the fact that you didn't kill me means you abandoned your brother and you're weak? Or there could be something of that in there? Because this guy's fucked up, right?
He might have been goading Butcher to kill him rather than dying slowly of ass cancer. He might have been like, you know, I'd rather my boy choke me out or kill me, break my neck.
Almost like the deal of this lifetime of like trying to teach him to be hard, right?
Right. This will be the last thing. And this is pretty time-tested tropes, you know, that like there's only one way to be a strong person. You have to have all this abuse and it makes you stronger and blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't know. I reject that dichotomy. I think that, you know, people can be strong from, in fact, maybe even stronger from well-rounded, being raised by well-rounded people. I mean, there's a reason that the fucking Spartans didn't take over the whole goddamn world, right? Like, you know, there's only so far that hyper-military shit can get you. And apparently it can't even get you out of fucking ancient Greece. So I do think that they could do something interesting, like, you know, like Huey can be a refutation of his dad and Lenny's weakness, or it could be something that paralyzes Butcher in the future. I don't know, but like, I also wonder if they'll ever resolve that, like what actually happened to Lenny. And again, to me, it's only interesting insofar as it says something about Butcher and his relationship with Huey.
Yeah, and I think you know hard times can certainly shape you. We're seeing that with a lot of our society now, and in the show, like, Annie is having some hard times, and it's definitely having its toll on her. But also, if you're a strong person, the only times when your courage and strength needs to come out is during hard times. You know, if everything is good and rosy, you may be strong, you may not be strong, but if you're never tested, you'll never know.
Sure.
And, you know, it seems like Butcher has been not just tested, but purposely crafted into this monster. And we'll see, like, kind of the results of that later in this episode. Which is why I think this scene even exists in the first place, is just so that we, like, oh, this is the episode where we want Butcher to go and threaten this guy and be a monster. So let's see a little bit of why he's a monster. You could have done this with a flashback, you know, like you were saying with Lenny stuff. You could have done this. But then I wonder, are they saying, okay, well, we don't want two flashbacks back to back. Like, they did it so well with Frenchie last episode. Maybe they didn't want to just repeat that cycle with Butcher here. And so they tried to invent a way to do it better.
As someone who gets, that's like Ryan Murphy's stock and trade, is like, you know, justification of character stuff, flashbacks. Like, it can get to be a little much.
Yeah.
Like, if everything that you need to know about a character comes in like a convenient 5-minute flashback right before you need to know it, that starts feeling really writerly really quick.
For sure.
But also,
this felt oddly writerly. Like, oh, they needed him to go talk to his dad this episode because they want me to know he's a monster before he just turns into a monster.
Right. And I love Carl Urban's performance. Like, he's so maniacal. Like, his, like, the way he does, it's like vintage Eomer finding out, like, choking Wormtongue to death because he wants to fuck his sister after he deposes his uncle. You know, like, it's like, this is some old school rat. Yeah, like, Butcher's a scary, scary person.
Even more so after this episode. Like, God, that tea drinking scene.
And
wow. Yeah, wow, Carl Urban.
Yeah. There's another one. I'll wait for my commentary on that. But yeah, that's another good one. Another good one.
Yeah. So after the rally, Homelander tells Stormfront that he thinks it's a mistake to keep Starlight alive. Stormfront doesn't think so. Baby catches her eye because it reminds her of her 80-year-old daughter, and Homelander decides, I'm going to take you to see my son, Ryan.
Mm-hmm. Since we're talking about offspring, I wonder if this is, how much of this is engineered by Stormfront, and how much of this is just her, you know, like, Homelander, did she want to meet his kid? Did she know about his kid?
I'm not sure she knew.
Man, if she was an old G Vought, like, from day one, literally was banging Mr. Vought.
Yeah,
like, it,
good point.
I find it, and also, like, how in love she was with Homelander, knowing all she was about it.
And
I guess the question
by Stan
is
Egger as well, who is running
that's,
this whole thing.
How much does Stan know about Stormfront is more of a question than I have about how much does Stormfront know about the inner dealings of Vought. I just assume she knows everything.
Well, I mean, I have questions about, like, how much is Vought's mission still tied up in Liberty's mission, the original mission of Vought?
Sure.
Like, have things changed? Is this now more of a pharmaceutical, you know, a more of a finance driven thing than, you know, this race war driven thing? Like, I don't know.
Because there's also an interesting way you could say that, like, you know, making a point about systemic racism is that, like, you know, Vought, the company, if they're not racist, why are 92% of all superheroes made white?
Yeah.
It could be not from any kind of, like, you know, like, they've forgotten their roots, but something in the system keeps perpetuating. Well, you know, white people test better in marketing because, you know, we associate white people superheroes. Like, you know, it's just a business decision. It's not where that's the difference between these systems that keep perpetuating themselves, keep perpetuating their own conditions and their own, you know, way of doing things long after the actual malice is gone. So are they doing that, or is it just Stan Edgar also secretly evil?
Yeah. Don't know.
Secretly still racist. That remains to be seen.
And then Homelander introduces Stormfront to Rebecca and Ryan. Stormfront tells him that he's the first natural-born superhero, which the first, really, since the 1930s, no soup that you've made and released into the wild has ever procreated. Never, not once. That's shocking
that
to me.
Passed on the super genes. And I think I'm more convinced than ever it's a work. There's no, They just shot that baby full of V. Shot that baby full of V. There's no way that this was genetically passed. I don't believe it. I think this might be the one thing Homelander and Stormfront don't accurately understand.
Could be.
And now that Dr.
Vogelbaum,
I knew something weird. Uh-huh. Dr. Vogelbaum got his head popped. Maybe that'll be a surprise that we discover together. But that's my number one theory, is that Ryan is not a natural born superhero.
Yeah, that would make a certain amount of sense. But Homelander wants them all to be a happy family.
God, this is super uncomfortable. All this like parental transgression, and there's nothing she can do to stop it. Oh, Jesus Christ. It's the worst. It's the worst.
Yeah. Lena tells Maeve that she's going to stay with her sister because of the video she saw and just, you know, how it's changed her opinion of Maeve. Maeve claims that Elena's finally getting what she wants, which is to see the real her, but it's kind of scary.
It's tragic, man. Sometimes you hide your true self from someone and they know it and they want it, and then they get more than they bargained for. And
especially with her.
Yeah, that flipping, like, you know, Maeve can be scary too, or flipping that table out of nowhere. It's funny that it felt like maybe Elena was frightened of her for the very first time.
Yeah.
It's really seeing what she's capable of, not just physically, but morally. And I don't know. It's like there's like a lot of backhanded compliment there. Like, I wish I was as strong as you. Like, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish I was strong as you did so I could. Is Maeve strong by going along with the flow because she's afraid for her own skin? And those who is that what makes someone strong?
Yeah, good question.
Put up with moral atrocities to, you know, that's that this episode constantly plays with that. Like, what's the right thing to do? To fight injustice even if it's going to get you killed? To stand up even if it's futile? Like, what is the right thing to do?
Yeah, by what means do you fight? You know, mm-hmm. Are you just going to fight evil with more evil? Do you have to do that? Is that the only effective means? And what are the what's the aftermath and the fallout from that? All kinds of things that they're hinting at here. But Grace shows up at Jonah Vogelbaum's house with MM and gets in on the strength of her name. He recognizes her. They ask what he knows about the tests going on at Sage Grove. He claims to not know anything, and Grace tries to be both good cop and bad cop in this scene. Not a very effective tactic, I wouldn't think. Everybody knows what she's doing here. Guy's not interested in helping them because of what Vought would do to his daughter if he did help them. And afterward, Grace tells him, just look, drop this whole thing, go back to your family, because I wish I had, and we're screwed here. There's not much we can do at all.
Man, does the Colonel make it out of this season? Because everything, like, Butcher mentioned how unusual it was for her to just give something away for free, and now she's essentially telling MM, I'm going to give you the same deal. Here's your family, here's your wife, a free ticket to Nicaragua, just get the hell out.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it seems like her arc is approaching turmoil. I was kind of surprised she made it out of this episode with her head intact.
Yeah.
What is the right thing to do? Is the right thing to do, you know, when is it right to stand up? I mean, we've talked about it all episode long, but I just really enjoyed this scene and the dark counterpart with Butcher later, where, you know, is that right to force a person to do the right thing? You know, it's interesting. So much of the stuff is black and white. This kind of like, well, what do you do in the face of this kind of evil? What's the right play?
I don't know. She's got the line, some things are more important than doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Which I feel is on the face of it untrue. There is nothing more important than doing the right thing. However, people have moments where certainly they value things more important than sacrificing themselves upon the altar of righteousness.
Sure, sure.
And I find it hard to blame people for that because people are people. And I wonder if that's like part of what Elena is going through with Maeve. Like Maeve is, you know, fighting, standing up against Homelander, and that's why she's strong, because she's decided to take on this monumental task, futile task almost, one that's almost certain to get her killed, and yet she's going to do it anyway.
Sure.
Maybe that's what Elena's getting at, the idea of standing up to Homelander with this tape. Maybe, if I'm being charitable. But yeah, I mean, that like not being able to, not putting the right thing ahead of whatever personal sacrifice you need to make to do it is kind of what gets us to the place where we are now.
Yeah, because in the counterpart, like how many people stood up to the Nazi regime and got steamrolled before they finally got brought to justice? How many people got disappeared by the Stasi and shot in some gulag before the Berlin Wall fell? Like individually, those people were just drips and drabs, but they added up to enough moral outrage. The whole world took notice and forced a change. So, yeah. It's like it's kind of like the prisoner's dilemma, right? The individual moral calculus is different than like repeated group actions, but like, you know, asking people to pay the supreme price when objectively it's not going to matter in the here and now, not for your family. You know, you have maximum consequences for very little societal gain. It's like, thank God we do have some crazy ass people that continue in the face of like drug dealers, you know, take lead or silver, take the lead. You know, thank God we have those crazy people, or we would just be ruled by thugs and warlords all the time. All of human history would be that, instead of that being kind of the aberration, at least for the last couple hundred years.
Yeah. And then we go to Butcher drinking at a bar. He gets a call saying it didn't go well with Vogelbaum, but he says, I'll take care of it.
Don't you worry, love. I got it. I got it covered. He's got to bollocks it.
All right, quick scene there. Frenchie and Kimiko keep tabs on the congresswoman. He said it's Newman is her name. Can't hear that name without thinking of Seinfeld. I'm watching Seinfeld right now, so...
Even worse.
Frenchie talks about the healing properties of cooking and tells Kimiko that he'd like to learn more about her family. And so she teaches him how to say a single word in her language, gun.
Interesting thing to start with. But, you know, it's what was at hand. She had that or the air-to-air missile thing. Did you notice that like Frenchie is presiding over this wicked-looking missile?
Is that, for some reason, I was thinking this was some kind of viewing device, like a telescope or something. It's a missile.
No, it looked like some kind of missile defense system, portable.
Is that supposed to be a soup defense?
It has to be. Like, it's worthless if it's not.
But I feel like it's worthless if it is.
I don't know. I'm saying they've done enough in the last few episodes to show that Frenchie is some kind of chemical genius with drugs that he could maybe make a missile that can anesthetize. Homelander, maybe not kill him, but like knock him out for a minute or two so I could get him. Maybe it's betting odds. It's the Vegas would take that proposition, I think.
They've just got a Mondo sized Almond Joy stuffed into the barrel of that thing.
Yeah, it's a broadband. Yeah, it's got some tree nut, it's got some weaponized Xanax, it's got a little bit of for everybody. Sure.
Then the Deep and A-Train chat at a church party. The church leader tells him that he's got a meeting with Stan Egger next week, and they'll probably be getting back into the Seven, so start celebrating. He also tells him that Eagle the Archer no longer exists because he spoke out against the church. Holy shit, this is culty. You're in until you're out, and then you are all the way out.
This is some 1984 doublethink, kind of like, you know, what do you think about this guy? Oh, he's my best friend. He's like a brother to me. He's a suppressive person.
All right, fuck him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then A-Train, you know, is looking at this and he sees it for the cult move that this is.
But he also wants to get back into Seven. And
I know.
I think you're supposed to understand here that, like, I wonder if they're... I wonder if one of them, first of all, this guy's saying a lot, but not promising anything. He's essentially says he's got a lunch with Stan Edgar. That's it. Yeah. He's going to have a lunch with Stan Edgar. Everything else is his showmanship and salesmanship. I do wonder if there's going to be a situation like it's going to be like the Joker breaks a cue stick in half and says, all right, there's one job opening. Who gets it? Uh-huh. Or is he just full of shit? Because the thing is like if he fails, all he's got to do is say, well, I didn't fail you. You failed the program. You know, sure. It was your toxic stuff that you didn't work through. You still hate your gills. You still are addicted to V. It's your problem. It's like it's, you know, and that's how these fucking cults work. Mm-hmm. If you get a blessing, it's because the system works for you and the big guy's looking out for you. And if you get cursed, you didn't believe strong enough. You fucked up. Like, there's nothing that can ever point back to the institution itself. And yeah, it is frightening to see a person like that turn their back on their best friends. But I've seen it. I've seen it in my own damn life. It's crazy.
Yeah, and the other wrinkle here is that, I guess, Eagle, you see this on TV when he's being interviewed. He would not denounce his mother, right? Like she said something about the church, and then he would not totally cut her out of his life, and so he was right. Cut off from the church. And god damn if that isn't my experience with life and cults. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. they nailed it in the kind of like over the top silly way that the boys does it.
The biggest liberty they're taking is L. Ron Hubbard, not a handsome man.
No, God, no.
This guy is very charming and handsome and appealing. So, like, ideal cult leader. I don't think L. Ron gets enough respect for how much cult train he pulled with that busted up wagon he had pulling it, you know? Like, this is the pinnacle. This is the pinnacle of billions of years of psychological research and human perfection and getting rid of body thetans. This guy, face like a dead mackerel. That's who you're going to follow? Okay. Wow. All right. Yeah. Sorry.
You're going to follow him onto a private boat? That's a little weird, too.
Don't. This guy flunked out of the Merchant Marines. Don't call him a Commodore and get on his boat, man. Don't.
No, like I get it. He's got a palace and there's a pool out back and fountains. Yeah. And
yeah.
Marble statues.
Hugh Hefner.
Yes.
Hefner. Tom T. Hefner could have started a bang up cult that people would have gladly followed.
Yeah, but when you're on Steamboat Willie's tugboat and you're asking people to join your cult, that's a hard sell.
Yeah,
and he did it.
It's always guys looking like the Unabomber or fucking L. Ron to start these things. It's not never Jude Law.
Fair. All right. Where were Lamplighter? Lamplighter takes Huey into Vaught Tower through his college girl entrance, and apparently he still has access.
They were applying to college. They weren't actually college girls yet.
Oh, right. So they must have been. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Just barely legal.
Yes, sure. Let's give these people the benefit of that.
Sure. Quick scene there. And then another quick
one. But it is interesting because there's a whole bunch of foreshadowing that he doesn't really care whether he lives or dies. Like how Cavalieri's like, well, this is either going to get us in or it's going to summon a bunch of guards with AK-47s. Like, there's the first of like, oh, it's not that he wants to be the hero. It's something else. And on second watch, I got a lot of these, but I enjoyed that.
For sure. And then Ashley finds Maeve sleeping with two men in her apartment and freaks out because they really need her to be a lesbian.
Just a pile of naked man ass.
Oh, yeah.
Sleeping on a king size mattress made of hunk.
I'm slightly confused by this scene. So what is she doing here? Is she drowning her sorrows in sex? Is she is she intentionally trying to get under Ashley's skin by defying her public image here? What exactly is she getting? All of the above?
I think she is being self-destructive in a way that is fucking over Vaught and Homelander's plans for her.
Okay. And also, you know, papering over her pain in the moment, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think I could say this is a commentary on, you know, there's this concept I've learned about in the last year or two about bi erasure, where it's like there's this pressure to like, well, people don't really understand how you could be attracted. Like, people can wrap their head around like a homosexual relationship because it's the inverse of a heterosexual relationship. But just like equally attracted to men and women, that grinds the old gears. So it's like, you know, you always want to. Isn't that there's a couple of I can remember just blowing up for some particular rapper who everyone was calling gay, and he kept on correcting, no, I'm bisexual. Mm-hmm. Because it's much more common to be, you know, a gay man or lesbian in fiction than someone who's just the plays for either team. And that's interesting, because even even Ashley said, like, this isn't the clean feel good story we wanted. And, you know, Maeve's like, well, fuck, I'm a messy bitch, so
yeah,
deal. It's pretty cool. It's like I said, they're Lovecraft Country is another one that's like they are driving in multiple lanes, swerving all over the place. With the commentary.
Then we go to Ryan recreating movies with his Lego. He's impressed to find out that his dad's in movies and he wants to see him. He also wants to ride his dad's roller coaster. I know what the boys, I got to be clear. That's not a euphemism. Rebecca's pissed. She takes Homelander outside, plays the mother card, telling him how important it is that Ryan have a mother and that he should understand that because of his upbringing. And he never had one. And you get the impression at the end of this scene that he agrees to leave Ryan with her. Or at least Rebecca got that impression.
No, I think he was convinced. I don't think he has enough guile to play it any other way. I just think that Stormfront, you know, was able to quickly disabuse him of this notion.
It's a question of, do you think that Homelander understands how fucked up and damaged he is? Because if he does, then that maybe plays. If he doesn't, if he thinks like I'm a god and there's nothing wrong with me. I don't need anyone but myself. Like he says when, you know, Doppelganger is trying to blow him or he's trying to blow himself. I wonder. It just makes me wonder.
It's tough because I saw like there's some similar scenes in like Casino between Robert De Niro and Al and then Joe Pesci where, you know, you're dealing with a psychotic person and you've got a bond with them. Like they do on some level still take you seriously. And you've got that last card. And you're like, when should I play it? When should I play it? When should I level with this person to try to keep them? And what happens a lot of times when you do that is like you, especially if you play it too late, is you appear to win the conversation and the person goes off and they start thinking, you know, because now they feel bad about themselves. You scored a wound that actually got to them, and now they're off and they're drinking and they're thinking about what you said. And it's not like how they can be better. It's more of like, fuck that guy. I can't believe he had this. I can't believe they're gonna pull this. They're gonna try to make me sound like I got mommy issues. And you got someone like Stormfront. It's just like, oh, so that's something for her to say. She's been lying to this kid all her life. That's not healthy. What's gonna like?
Yeah.
You know. Then so I do think that Homelander knows he's got a problem with he's got a big mommy shaped hole in his heart and it's fucking him up. He knows that.
Yeah.
But he doesn't like to be reminded of it, especially by someone who's lying to his son and keeping him suppressed. So it's like,
sure.
I thought it was great. I thought that and the elation that, like, you know, the relief that Becca feels just heightens how the betrayal and the anguish that she feels in later. I thought it was good. And I do believe that Homelander still gettable. Like Madeline did that to him all season last year, like played her cards, but then just she ran out of cards. And I think Becca did the same thing here.
Yeah. So Butcher shows up at Vogelbaum's house. He asks what Homelander was like when he was growing up. Apparently he was sweet when he was young. And then they made sure that that didn't last. They wanted him to turn out strong, which, you know, ties back into Butcher's theme this episode. Mm-hmm. Butcher tells Vogelbaum that he's going to kill his entire family today if he doesn't help him. And he's pretty convincing. Goddamn, Carl Urban.
Whew. The way he takes that cup of tea and just like drinks it in one gulp and then it smiles.
He's taking it from his daughter, right? His daughter is the one serving that tea?
Yep, yep, yep.
Yeah, it's
the opposite. It's the opposite of, you know, the colonel came in there and she dismisses the tea because she's all business, where Billy, he's the opposite. I love it because it's also like, is Butcher a monster? Is he bluffing? Would he do this? I think he probably would. And it's based on the same logic of like, you know, because this is some great dialogue and some great acting. You know, this doctor's like, hey, I did this. And it's also interesting that they filled his Homelander's head full of like these rugged frontier manifest destiny type heroes. And he's like, did you, Butcher asked him, like, in all this God making, did you ever think of the pain you cause people like me? And the doctor's like, it's not even on my radar. Mm-hmm. So then Butcher's like, well, thanks for letting me know, because now I'm going to tell you how I'm going to specifically cause you pain. And I don't have to feel bad about it because you don't even think about the pain that you cause people like me.
Yeah. And there's a bit of what we talked about with Homelander.
Makes sense, right?
You know, mm-hmm. understanding his damage and reacting in the opposite way you would want someone to react when they understand how they're broken. They mm-hmm. lean into it. And I think that's what Butcher is doing here, right? He's leaning into being the monster. Okay, his father's going to turn him into a monster. Fine, I'll show you a fucking monster. I'll go to this man's house and I'll kill every single one of his family, become the monster that you say I am, to almost as a weird way to spite his father, but also himself. It's self-destructive.
Be a monster for good, you know, kind of.
And yeah, that's why I have the question, you know, in my rattling around in my head, do you need a monster to fight monsters? And it's never, I guess, it's never more of a question than when you have soups, like literally superpowered beings who you can't fight through any other means. Do you need soups to fight soups? Do you need monsters to fight monsters?
God, I wonder if where they're going with this is that Billy is going to be forced to adopt Ryan with Becca and use some of his dad's psychology to make that monster that they need to fight the other monsters, because that would be kind of satisfying as from just a purely, again, how fucking nihilist and dark does the show want to get?
Sure.
But yeah, this Urban's performance here and that line where he's like, to tell the truth, you weren't even on my radar. And he gets up, he's like, tell me, Doc, what's your radar saying now, as he advances on him? It's really good.
Let me ask you this. We've now got Compound V being set up via the Sage Grove facility as a thing that maybe you could inject into adults and give them superpowers.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And they might become perhaps even less stable than someone like Butcher, let's say, would be normally. You inject Butcher with this, and now one of the boys, you know, I guess one of the original four boys has superpowers, and it's the monstrous one, right? Who's going to go off and do monstrous things to Homelander for good.
Mm-hmm.
What does he become after that? And, you know,
he warps back around to being a pure white paladin. He's just evil in him at all.
Uh-huh. Turns into Lenny.
It's Horde's ultimate horseshoe theory. You just bend back around. Yeah.
No, I don't know. There's all kinds of places this show could go, and I don't know where the comics go.
Yeah, same.
And I kind of don't want to find out, because those possibilities that are rattling around inside my head are one of the most interesting things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Lamplighter takes Huey to where he thinks Starlight is. He notices that he's not in the Statue of the Seven anymore, and he's disappointed because it means that he can't carry out his plan of killing himself in front of his own statue. But he self-immolates anyway. And then the lights in Starlight's cell turn on because there's some, I don't know, fire escape protocol, some emergency protocol in the building.
Sure.
She uses that energy to blast her way out. Huey has
to... You want your super terrorists to burn to death because they couldn't find the exit.
Right. Right. All your prisoners, yeah. Huey has to cut off and take Lamplighter's hand to get past the security checks. Black Noir finds Annie, and they fight, and Annie loses, but Maeve steps in and incapacitates him with an Almond Joy. I guess I'll stop there for now.
Okay. I was very proud of myself for noticing the statue switching they were doing, because I felt like that really paid off. Although I looked, there's only six people on the Statue of the Seven, and one of them's got no head, and I don't know who the hell they're supposed to be. Like, is it supposed to be them working on transforming someone into Stormfront or something? But like,
oh, is it maybe like
there's
A-Train?
Six figures? No, A-Train's on. No. Everyone's accounted for. They got Maeve, A-Train. Even the Deep is still on there.
Starlight,
Homelander, Starlight is there. Yeah, Black Noir. But there's a head with there's a torso with no head, and then there's one entirely missing. Lamplighter. But that, like, yeah, the fact that he's wanting to do, you know, a Buddhist monk in front of this statue and he's not able to.
Yeah.
Huey chopping this guy's arm off, becoming the John. He's kind of becoming awesome. He's John Connor in this shit, right? The other thing I noticed, and I've been giving Jack Quaid a lot of grief on our Sunday night Super Sci-Fi Sundays.
Right. I mean, who's the real monster here?
I've been giving him a lot of grief about being Monster Man, but at 41 minutes and 45 seconds of the episode, he turns into a literal Monster Man. As Starlight escapes from his prison and they pivot back to him getting rained on, he makes this, and he is like for three frames completely just Boris Karloff Frankenstein, unironically.
Wow.
He's a Monster Man. He's a Monster Man. That's not that you can be a successful Monster Man. You can be a handsome Monster Man. Attractive, viral Monster Man. He is one.
All right, I got two questions for you regarding...
Sure.
Well, three regarding Black Noir. Why doesn't Annie blast him? There's power everywhere in this room. She doesn't. She just fights him hand to hand.
Yeah.
That's a rhetorical question. It's not even...
Wait, I thought they did a little bit to where she was more than holding her own against him, and then she just gets distracted by the horror of Lamplighter's body. And then she trips, and then from that point, like, Black Noir's just on her. And why can't she get it together enough to focus blast him? I don't know, but, like, I thought they were trying to tell that story, and they did.
Okay. I suppose. Well enough. The other two questions. What, is Black Noir black, and is Black Noir dead?
I think Black Noir is... He did look like a black man. Okay. Underneath the costume.
I couldn't tell because he also seems to have some scarring. Pretty severe scarring on his face. And I couldn't tell if it was like that was scarred skin or if he's supposed to be a black man, which would make kind of sense if he is a superpowered black man in the Seven and he's also like completely covered, you know, head to toe and never reveals his identity.
It feels like they're going for like a black version of Deadpool, that he is hideously scarred because that's apparently a superhero's power, is that he's durable, but like, you know, he doesn't heal perfectly. He's a lot like Wade Wilson, I guess.
I was also thinking of what's the guy in Watchmen who never showed his identity, and then we find out his identity in the series.
Rorschach.
No. The guy who turns out to be black.
Hood of Justice.
Hood of Justice, yes. It's a little bit of that kind of feeling to me, too.
I can get that.
Is he dead? He got an almondoid down his esophagus, down his windpipe or something, and he's got a tree nut allergy.
I mean, she didn't destroy his EpiPen. She just kicked it away. So I'm guessing that he can stagger and over there and inject himself before his throat fully closes.
Maybe he collapses at the end of that scene into a heap on the floor. So I'm not even sure he's conscious.
He is Black Noir, though. The bigger problem is now that they reveal there's two black men on the Seven, like now they're overrepresented. 30% of the Seven's African-American when they only make up 13% of the population. This is outrageous.
Well, I mean, 0%.
Outrageous.
0%. If Black Noir is dead, it's 0% now because A-Train's off.
Okay. Well, now, sure. You gotta hopefully find a black woman, as we've discussed. Dude, that's what will truly bring balance to the Seven.
Sure. That'll do it. I'm sure of it.
No, I think, I don't know. I do think this is
as part of the Seven. I'm sure bringing in one strong black woman is going to fix everything.
Sure. I do think this is the first time they've actually like foreshadowed some kind of weakness bringing down a Seven, though, right? Like who the hell could have told that he's got a tree nut allergy? So that puts me on a radar of thinking of like, what's the off the wall weird mundane thing that Homelander could suffer from?
Yeah.
That we don't know.
I don't know. It's not, I haven't seen any kryptonite-esque substances in the show yet.
Especially since this
almond
was also
the closest thing we've got to kryptonite at this point.
Right. And I also loved how they kind of highlighted it by focusing, you know, making it be such a prominent thing in the show before.
And then Annie in this scene is like, was that an almond joy?
Yeah, and it makes me wonder if, like, maybe almond joy is actually a secretly popular candy bar, but they like this. The Vought has campaigned and marketed it terribly so that it's not a very popular to protect Black Noir.
Oh God,
we got to get Almond Joy off the streets, but we can't be. We just got to make sure everyone knows that it just sucks. Sucks. It's terrible candy. Don't buy it. You don't want that falling into wrong hands.
You know, I hadn't considered that. It's like Superman going on an anti-kryptonite campaign.
Like, yeah, getting on but social not saying media. It's dangerous to me. It's like kryptonite just sucks. It's right. Dangerous. It hurts babies. Dogs hate it. It's just, it's terrible. You know, it's tacky.
It's garbage
you don't want
rock.
It.
It's garbage yeah. rock. Throw that shit
you
in the dumpster.
You don't want kryptonite rings. Yeah. Yeah. It's like if your boyfriend brings a kryptonite ring, dump his ass because that shit's worth more tackier than cubic zirconium.
Gotcha. I'd believe it. So then Huey releases Annie's mother from her cell and finds Annie in the halls, and she's touched that he came for her, but they have to keep moving.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's not much to that scene.
It's great. I mean, the Monster Man did a great job. He made me laugh unironically with his reaction to the Starlight's mom saying, "Is that a human hand?" Well, yes. Yes, it is. Now, come. We're all in danger.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
And then Rebecca makes dinner for her new soup family. But Ryan's not in an eating mood because Homelander has shown him the fake house and fake life that he's been living in. Ryan declares that he hates his mother, and then Homelander and Stormfront fly off with him. That's it, man.
Brave.
Game over.
Brave Maeve vegetarian lasagna.
The meatless recipe, which to meatless. Me is mm-hmm. pretty hilarious.
Yep.
See what you did there.
Don't want any sausage. Don't want any sausage in that lasagna.
Hell no.
No
love sausage, especially.
I mean, this is a good scene. Like, this is probably how it would play out. Like, if your dad comes home and, you know, he scared you once, but he apologized for it, so he's never going to do it again. And now, like, look at your mom. She's telling you think I'm bad. Look at your mom. She's telling you lies. She's trying to keep you, what do you see? 12, 13? You tell any 12, 13-year-old their parents are secretly keeping a much wider world from them. Oh, my God. Yeah, you got instant rebel, superpowered rebel.
Yeah, and this... You know, exactly mirrors the way that Homelander was raised, right? He was sweet until he was 5 or 6. We got Ryan here who's sweet until he meets his dad. And now he's under the tutelage of the world's most powerful superhuman and the world's most racist superhuman. And maybe they both are, you know, it's like,
sure.
What kind of hope is there for this kid to turn out any kind of normal?
Yeah, and you're right that scene with the Vogelbaum does some heavy lifting in that it shows that, like, well, you can think, well, you know, Ryan got a couple good years and he's a sweet kid. Well, so did Homelander. He got to a certain age before he got twisted and evil. So, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of paints a much darker picture than I might have because I might think, oh, maybe Ryan will be okay. Maybe the lessons his mother taught him, you know, he'll see through all the shit. But no, I don't know about that.
Yeah, you throw in some absolute power, and it's a bad deal. And also, just like, man, from Becca's perspective, how helpless. Like,
oh, yeah.
You have no power. You can do nothing to watch your child just get swept away by these mad people.
Mm-hmm.
I felt really bad for her.
How much of a reason do they have to keep her around, Vought? I think there's any chance that Vought exterminates Becca now that she is of no use, or maybe
Vought
is of
cool?
Use.
Like they said that the company no longer wants to antagonize Homelander over this, but like Vought went along with this willingly. Like this was their plan as much as it was Becca's, right? We don't know exactly. So I don't know. Is Homelander going? Is like Stan Edgar going to drink a bottle of V and be like, unhand the boy, Homelander, next episode? I don't know. I can't wait to watch it, but
sure.
I don't know. That's a great question though. What happens now? Is Vought a little bit more engaged with reeling Homelander in?
I mean, we've
gotten so caught up in like Stormfront Homelander racist reunion tour. That we forgot that like the season started off with massive friction between Vought and Homelander. And we thought that Stormfront was something to try to put the kibosh on that, but it might be something that Stan Edgar has lost control over. But yeah, what is Vought's response going to be to this? We haven't seen anything from them for a while.
Yeah. And what's Rebecca's utility, I guess, to them now? Can yeah. they use her somehow? Because she's clearly shown that she has no effect on Homelander whatsoever, right? He's going to do whatever he's going to do.
I think she played as her last card, and it lasted yeah. for about 30 minutes.
I get the feeling that, like, Rebecca, she's got to meet up one last time with Butcher, I think, in some yeah. way, especially now that her kid is gone. Like, that piece of the puzzle is sort of out of the picture now, so maybe that changes her and Butcher's relationship a little bit, but also he's still a monster and she knows it. I don't know where it goes from here, but I feel like this is not the last time we've seen Rebecca.
I agree. I mean, I think, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how Butcher reacts to this, whether this changes the calculus about her wanting to get away. If she's going to be liquidated yeah. by Vought, then can Butcher save her?
Yeah.
Is this going to, yeah. Oh, I had another question about a previous scene. Why didn't Maeve go with Starlight?
Oh, I think she's trying to take down Homelander, and the best place for her to be is within the Seven to do that.
Or has she given up? Because I almost think that, like, maybe she's the opposite side of she's essentially the one good person we're tracking that's kind of at least temporarily taken Colonel Mallory's advice of just let go and try to make the best out of whatever you got, because, you know, Maeve has now lost the person she cared for and she's got nothing to do but drown her sorrows in vape pens and a pile of boys. So
yeah, I'm just hoping she's the counterpoint to the idea that, you know, it's Grace's sentiment that it's much more important to, you know, take care of your family than do the right thing. I'm hoping that Maeve, having lost her family, whatever, you know, kind of family Elena was, is now in a position to just straight up do the right thing, has nothing left to lose.
Gotcha.
But maybe that's a false hope. We'll see. So Huey, Annie, and Annie's mother all get back to the boys' hideout. Everyone's there now. They're all pissed that Lamplighter is dead, and Grace calls Butcher, who says, not to worry, because he's handling it. And then Butcher goes and meets with his mother, who says that she was only trying to get Butcher to let go of the anger that he's got so that he doesn't become his father. There's no indication as to what Butcher's next move is here, but he's got some path forward. And he's a monster, so who knows?
I think he's essentially saying, don't worry, I've got Vogelboom. Like, he's going to testify for you because I threatened the shit out of him, so don't worry about Lamplighter.
Okay, but he also has this look at the end of the episode, though, after Vogelbaum's head explodes, and he's got this look into the camera that says, I know exactly what to do, and it's going to be
fucked. Oh, do you?
Because
I wrote down my question. I wonder if that's because you... Yeah, I don't know, because I had the thought of, like, this is Butcher thinking, like, he's at his, like, lowest moment. Like, he's filled with rage, maybe, but it's impotent rage.
And that brings, like, a weird, perverse smile to his face. Like,
he thought it's he a feeling he's comfortable end? With.
I think so. It's hard to tell sometimes with Carl Urban if he's grimacing or smiling.
That's true. Yeah, and I thought he was, like, that's impotent rage. But, yeah.
Okay.
But then I thought that his card was Vogelboom, because otherwise,
yeah, you're right.
No fucking clue. He's on some mission, side mission to the side mission that we already knew he was on, and they're keeping all those cards tight to the vest.
No, it's definitely Vogelboom. You're right about that. I'm just wondering at the end of this episode if he's got some other card up his sleeve that he's about to play. I don't know.
Better. I don't know. Better have a plan. Better be meeting, you know, Lando and Leia at Jabba's palace, because right now the Empire's done struck.
Yeah,
guys, lost a lot of limbs this episode, more than just Lamplighter.
And there's this final scene, it's a final.
Can we talk about his mother? Like, what was his? I thought, what was his mother trying to do? He wouldn't have this whole. See, this is again. There's this mystery. There's this mystery with Lenny, and I don't quite care. But, like, also, it could be awesome. But she trails off. She's like, you know, I didn't do it for him. I thought you would be able to let him go. He wouldn't have this hold over you that you wouldn't become like. And she trails off. Well, how the hell could he possibly turn out like Lenny? He's nothing like Lenny.
Yeah, I read it as wouldn't turn out like him, his father, but. You're right, she does trail off. She never actually says it, so I'm not sure.
Right. So now you have to assume that his father had the exact same upbringing, which I guess that tracks, but, like, I feel like they need to do something with the narrative to suggest that's true. I think there's some mystery with Lenny that is going to be a puzzle piece that fits in.
Yeah. I didn't get any of that coming into this, but I think you've convinced me. Yeah, there's something more to Lenny. And we got this final like series of blended scenes where the Deep and A-Train are watching Eagle on TV explaining what happened with the church. The Deep says, fuck him. And they turn the channel to the Vought Compound V hearing. The boys are also watching it. It's kind of like a blending of cuts back and forth. They call Vogelbaum in to testify, and people's heads just start exploding left and right. Grace is able to get the Congresswoman Newman out alive, but Vogelbaum's head is gone. There's no chance that anybody...
Everyone watching in horror, man.
So, yeah. I mean, it's completely fucked up scene in that boy's way that I love so much. But I have so many questions about, like, is Vogelbaum really more afraid of Butcher than he is of Homelander? I guess it's the immediacy of the thing, right? Like, maybe, okay, Butcher says, I'm going to do it today. I'm going to do it right now. I'm going to stand up and walk over and kill these people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Kill your family, as opposed to Homelander may do that. You know, Vought may do like that Homelander, to him in the future.
Yeah, or like, I think Homelander would just zap your head. It's like Homelander doesn't... I don't think Homelander would think to hunt down all of his kids and their kids and kill them all, whereas Butcher would. You know, it's like... Homelander is the bolt from the blue, the lightning bolt from heaven, where Butcher is the cluster bomb, you know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, yeah, well, I'm putting myself in danger, but maybe not my family. But the episode kind of undermines that, because I feel like the doctor said as much, that like, well, yeah, I don't care. You do what you want to me. It's all about protecting my family.
Right.
So... Yeah, but you're right. Yeah. It could be, well, I've got the gun to the head right now, so you can worry about Homelander all you want. This is happening now. You might be right.
I'm looking at the people's heads who are exploding in this scene, and it's Vogelbaum. It's a bunch of random people who we don't really know.
Sure.
It seems pretty targeted, I'd say. Like, I'm going to say the only guy who we know who gets exploded in here is Vogelbaum, who is, you know, this doctor who worked on Compound V and is, you know, tied with Vought. And it makes me think that maybe a bunch of these other people who get exploded, like the people who don't, I think, are the most conspicuous. Mm-hmm. The Congresswoman doesn't get her head exploded. Grace doesn't get her head exploded. None of the soups there get their heads exploded. To me, that says...
There's like a minor costume soup that was kind of serving as A-Train's a bailiff.
Replacement.
Hey, right. That's who it was. That's what I thought it was. Yeah, he gets his head exploded.
Right.
Could they explode?
Shit, why would he?
Can they explode Homelander's head? When Homelander and Stormfront were looking around, I wasn't sure if they were like theatrically being like bewildered at what's happening. They were trying to like plausibly, deniably be bewildered what's happening. They're just callous and they don't like, well, this is something that's like, this sucks, boy. Wonder what's causing it. Like, but. You know,
yeah,
of a cop at Dunkin' Donuts that's like, yeah, I'll get there. I'll get there as soon as I had my coffee and my Dunkin', you know.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what they're trying to go for that. And like, it does seem like that. Cindy.
Yeah.
From the Sage Grove. It seems like that's her deal.
She would certainly have the power to do this.
Yeah, it's in her wheelhouse, so. Horrific effects, though. Those heads exploding and the stumps of bodies collapsing and.
But she is killing all the Vought people, wild. Right? She doesn't seem to be killing any of the non-Vought or anti-Vought people in this room that we know of.
She killed whoever is the oversight committee chairman. The guy banging the gavel. He got his head exploded too.
Is this just totally random? This seems just completely random. Why?
Because that's the other thing. I don't know. Because like
a fear
is
campaign.
Is Cindy even on the leash anymore? Like, is she working for Vought or is
no?
She
I
just,
think she's on her own.
Why would she be doing this? Why does she give a fuck?
Because they experimented on her, I assume.
But this is exposing Vought. This would bring Vought down, right?
Yeah. But she just wants to kill him. Like, who gives?
I'm wondering
a shit
if
about
this
them getting legally brought up.
I wonder if Cindy's a red herring that like, cause like the Could other be. Thing, there's a subtle difference. Cindy did full body explosions.
Yes.
Okay. this other thing that we've seen with Rainer and these people are just head explosions. I'm not saying that she can't just squeeze a head.
Sure.
I'm just saying that there is a difference in motif, and I'm wondering if somehow this will be another Vought win, where it's like, oh, we undercovered this, we found this undercover lab that we're voluntarily disclosing that was run by another faction of unauthorized, unsanctioned faction of Vought, and their head super terrorist Cindy is the person that did this, and this is her powers. But secretly, you're supposed to realize that they just that it's just another frame up. It's a simultaneous frame up and cleanup of something embarrassing to them.
I mean, they're absolutely
no longer needed.
They're going to spin this, right? This is going to be super terrorists attacking Vought, killing A-Train, like. This is the second time it's happened. Translucent,
not A-Train,
now A-Train.
The A-Train substitute.
No, like, wait. As far as the public is concerned, A-Train. Like, they made a point of him.
Oh,
like, they
right.
own the trademark A-Train, and therefore he will just become
A-Train. It's now red, but yeah, he had the A logo on his you're right, that is A-Train.
Okay. Yeah, they just replaced him with another dude and kept the same name. So, like, yeah, they can now claim, oh, Translucent, and now A-Train. This is a terror campaign. We've got to go after them even harder. They're going to spin this for sure.
Yeah. And this, like Huey says, what the fuck do we do now? I don't know. I honestly, with one episode, again, this feels very, very much Empire Strikes Back. We're going to have another episode where we have, maybe a minor victory. You know, maybe you can chase Darth Vader off of Cloud City, but things look grim. Not an easy path forward.
In this scene, they also do another one of those like superhero ass things that they do in this show, which is to have, keep in mind, this is a congressional hearing, like one of the most formal settings that we have on the planet at this point.
Sure.
And they're in there in their A-Train costume, in their Homelander costume, in their skimpy ass Maeve costumes. They are showing up to a congressional hearing in their superhero costumes. Hell,
yeah! You can't get a Homelander in a suit,
right?
What are you gonna do?
It's silly, but that's the boys for this week.
I'd love to see Black Noir in a suit, just him with his like tactical riot gear head with a Armani suit. Or like, what would Homelander show? What would his suit like? Would it be still red, white, and blue? Would it have would like the inside of his suit coat have like stars and stripes? I'm kind of curious to see what that looks like. What's formal super, kind of like when Wonder Woman shows up with her in the movie, where she's in a ballroom gown with her sword holstered into her ass somehow. Like, yeah, what's the formal version of their costumes? I want to see it.
That's it, man.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is reward unto itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Okay, we got some feedback for this episode. Would you like to consider that with me, Jim?
Sure. Why not?
Jimothy, your formal name. I got to open up by say fully one third of the Los Angeles metropolitan community sent in to DHS@baldmove.com that Sugarfish is not an off-brand Swedish fish, which I had surmised. I thought, oh wow, they can get clearance from Almond Joy to just run that brand to the ground, but you can't touch Swedish fish. Can't go after big Sweden fish. But no, it turns out Sugarfish is either overrated, the best, or merely good for its price sushi chain in LA and other major metro areas such as New York City.
So it's like every other sushi joint in the world, sushi brand.
Yeah, but I guess it's like a world famous sushi chef, and they got like really attractive boxing and presentation, and their price point's like $10 to $15 per person, so it's like attainable luxury sushi. So yeah, it's sweeping the nation. Everybody's enthralled with it, and so is Queen Maeve. And maybe in 10 years' time, if they're really successful and this COVID stuff doesn't kill them, they can open up a shop in Cincinnati. Maybe.
Sure. I bet that's their next point, their next destination.
I mean, we're just now getting avocado toast over here, so who knows how far behind we are in the Sugarfish there. But yeah, no, I'll give credit to Heather J for being the first of many, many, many people to use all social media and email to send in that tidbit. So thank you. Thank you for that. Basil, slightly less popular piece of information conveyed to me. Apparently, this is a big thing in the UK, which makes sense because it's Billy Butcher. Basil says, I'm surprised that in all the reviews I've seen and heard so far, nobody mentioned the reference to the episode title. This was for Blow the Bloody Doors Off. The Bloody Doors Off was the episode title. Mm-hmm. You and I, as Americans, the blowing the doors off means like beating someone in the race. Like if you... Yeah. You know, pass someone, you blew their doors off, right? But there's a boys comic with this title, according to Basil. And the most likely inspiration is a very famous scene in the British cult classic, The Italian Job, which I've never seen. I've seen their modern remake with Wahlberg and Ed Norton and all that. But the 1969 version, Michael Caine says that they were testing out something, some explosives. And this car just gets like, you know, nuclear bomb test sited, and Michael Caine exclaims, "You were only supposed to blow the bloody doors off." So apparently, this is in the UK shorthand for going above and beyond, but not in the direction you wanted to. Like you know, you're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. So that makes a lot of sense. I thanks for explaining to us across the pond this little British witticism. All right, on to the real email. And again, I encourage you to use DHS, Department of Homeland Security, DHS@baldmove.com to send in your feedback for the boys. Adam's up. He goes, I know it's been a few weeks since you were talking about Black Noir and wondering what their deal is. I've been thinking about it and being with him being nonverbal, the emotional meltdown in the hallway and the instance of not knowing how to interact with a child. I'm wondering if Black Noir is supposed to be autistic. To be clear, I'm autistic. I know there's a habit I share with the rest of the autistic community of deciding characters or people are autistic in their own personal headcanon. For example, Zuko, Archer, Dirk Gently. I know I'm primed to look for that sort of thing. I'd be curious to know what other people's thoughts are, but I'm also not sure I trust the show to handle an autistic character in a way that isn't stereotyped or fucked up. I mean,
that's not really their MO, yeah.
Yeah, they are not exactly addressing issues with tact and good taste, I would say.
Yep.
So anyway, what do you think about this? Is Black Noir autistic?
Yeah, I mean, in the way that you are primed to see that stuff, I'm not primed to see it. That's sure. certainly not something I think about in my everyday life. So it hadn't occurred to me, but it's totally possible. Yeah. And it has especially me a little since, worried as well. With the
especially
way
since you have already a prominent character as a mute because of trauma. So like I wasn't like going towards that. I was thinking that might be, well, you know, you inject somebody with V and it does this, it does that. But it makes a certain amount of sense. But yeah, I wouldn't hold out hope that you're going to get a very positive depiction of the full rich life of an autistic person from Black Noir or The Boys. You know, hey, you're in good company because as far as I can tell, they're targeting everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Matt S., I have a question about Ryan's importance. Ryan, of course, being the son of Homelander and Becca. Do you think he's the first soup that has powers without being injected with Compound V as an infant? Is that why he's being studied so closely by Vought? I mean, we've talked about this before, but only in passing. Do you have a read now, like now that we're a little bit further in the season about whether... Because I think that the show's point of view so far is that he is the first natural-born super on the planet.
That's what they keep saying.
I don't know why we, as a viewer, are taking that as a given. Like, is it... I mean...
Well, I don't have anything to refute it, so... I guess I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. I'm going along with what they're telling me until I have some reason not to.
I mean, Stormfront had a daughter, not super. I mean, unless her superpower was getting Alzheimer's in old age and dying, she was not super.
True.
So there's already like a negative case. But I just think that it's like this kid's been in Vought custody since the day he was born. Why would we assume that this is but I don't know. It also makes sense that if he is the first natural born soup, then Vought would take interest and want to isolate him and study him and all that kind of thing too. But I don't think it's open and shut. I think it's an intentional mystery that the show has kind of put forth, and then it doesn't seem like there's a lot of people that's super interested in it. They're taking the official story at face value. But I don't know. It's one of those things where it can make sense either way, right? It's fantasy, so
sure,
it's not
sure.
Like there's a scientific answer or something you can divine. But the show's got a point of view that they're definitely pushing.
Yeah, and I mean that Stormfront little factoid there that she's got a daughter who certainly didn't inherit her superpower or one of her superpowers, which doesn't seem like Homelander's son, right? Homelander. His son, Ryan, has seemingly inherited every superpower that Homelander has, or at least that's the assumption. He certainly inherited some sort of generic superhero invincibility. But yeah, her daughter wouldn't have inherited the thing that makes her live, indefinitely long. I don't know. That seems strange. Yeah.
And I don't, that's the thing is like, we've got a couple, we got a question about that on superpowers. In fact, and maybe I can just skip down to that one real quick. Vincent, has a question. Do you think that all supers have impenetrable skin by default? Lamplighter seems to respond hesitantly to having a gun pointed at him and seem to accept that Mallory could shoot him.
Not impenetrable. Like you see Starlight, even she can be, dremeled into, right? Like,
sure.
You can do it. It's not like Homelander where you literally probably can't get through his skin or translucent with diamond skin, whatever.
And Gecko has extremely penetrable skin, but he just regenerates quickly.
Good point.
There's more than one way to be well nigh invulnerable, as Stan Lee would put it over on Marvel Comics. You can be fastly regenerating. You can have some kind of magical protection aura. You can... be made out of like Stern's, what was it? Colossus made out of organic steel. That's why he's tough. You can also just very rapid regeneration.
Yeah, you can have stuff pass through you, and not be able to interact with things when you don't want to, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it could be intangible. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But I honestly don't know. Like, I don't know that we've seen enough. We only see the AAA top tier superheroes, and the regional ones seem like they're much less impressive. Like, does the Eagle, the Archer, have bulletproof skin? I don't know. I don't know. He doesn't seem superhuman at all, except for his inerring accuracy of bow and arrow. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's too soon to say, but I do think that every time I see a soup show up, I assume they're going to be a tough kill at the very least. Okay. Ian writes in, love your podcast, guys. One part of the episode of The Boys I felt was ignored and it frustrated me, which was when Frenchie is revived from his overdose, or Frenchie's friend is revived from his overdose. Just when Frenchie is about to leave, his friend gives him a look that says something. It was hard to understand at first, but when I turned on the subtitles, his friend said, Serge? Is that Frenchie's real name, or Sergio, perhaps?
Did we not mention this?
Well, you mentioned it and I shut it down because I'm like, what are you talking about? Okay. I didn't hear it in that kind of... and also, like, I've never heard of someone called Serge. I've heard of Sergey. Yeah. But Serge, like, I guess, yeah, I never thought of it like being a short from Sergio, because I've definitely heard Sergio before.
Mm-hmm.
Could be. But that definitely, I think that came up in this episode as well. His name mentioned a few times, and I actually looked up. I took a risk and looked up on the boys' wiki, and it lists his real name as Serge. So yeah, it is his real name. Yeah. We've uncovered it.
What does it have to do with Fresca? That's what I want to know.
That's the world wants to know. Groovy D says, would it be beyond the pale to want to dive deeper into the owner of the hijacked car from episode 6, assuming it's not beyond the pale? I mean, it's The Boys. I don't think anything's beyond the pale for the show or this podcast. He's apparently supposed to be a suburban regular dad with a cute sedan and a car seat in the back, but my dude is driving in the middle of the woods and arms reach away from a loaded pistol in the same zip code as our Nazi DNA testing facility. I'm not saying he's up to no good, but I'm also not saying it. As a lifelong Pennsylvania resident, it's not the most difficult place to procure and carry firearms, but the person that this guy was projecting, the persona this guy is projecting, doesn't seem like the type to be packing that kind of heat. What do you think about that? I didn't give it much thought. I thought this was a comment on Castle Doctrine, stand your ground states, you know, Americans' proclivity towards guns and gun violence.
Look, I just think we have, you know, hundreds upon hundreds of millions of guns in this country. They're going to end up in glove compartments.
Over 400 million.
Right. Of average, everyday kind of suburban Pennsylvanians, right? Like they're just going to end up there. Like, I didn't think there was much to dig into on this guy and how weird this is, because it's not fucking weird, right?
I do think that a lot of people that live in the more urban areas of America think that gun ownership is not as common as it is.
Oh,
like,
boy.
Fully 50%, like, again, 420 some million guns, more than enough for every man, woman, and child in this country. Over 50% of U.S. households report having a gun owner living under the roof. Like, it's literally a coin flip, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly more prevalent in some areas than others, but like, yeah, they're everywhere. I didn't think that's, and I think you'd be shocked at knowing, like, if you went to any random place of employment, you'd be shocked at how many guns are in trunks and glove compartments there. Really would. Peter also wanted to talk about this guy a little bit. He wrote in and said, during the last episode of Boys, I want to talk about the civilian who got killed by Starlight because he wanted to be a hero during their Grand Theft Auto moment. During the whole scene, I was really distracted by two thoughts. A, there's nothing that I own other than perhaps my dog that I wouldn't happily give away during any sort of burglary at the time in order to protect my well-being. And B, me trying to get through A to gel with the question of, under what circumstances would I put my life at risk to protect a fucking Hyundai from being stolen? Even though we're the last Hyundai in existence and it was a special edition and that was the last car left on the planet, I still think I just let him have it. Isn't this a rule from Zombieland? Don't be a hero? People get gripped up sometimes and they do dumb stuff. Like, speaking of my experience with gun owners, there's a few gun owners that do carry, and their kind of attitude is a lot more I wish a motherfucker would than I would be comfortable with.
Yeah.
Like, I do think some of these people that carry, like, some of them do it soberly and responsibly, but a lot of them are kind of like itching for a reason to use it. I don't know about this guy. They did mention that they're out in the middle of nowhere, like that this would be like a and you know, is this guy even wounded? Like, I don't think that it was just like, oh, they're taking my car. It's more of like, am I getting kidnapped, shanghaied, you know, taken, are they going to hurt me? Is this like one of those urban legends where someone, you know, like they take advantage of the goodness of your heart and leave you dead in the ditch? I think that's what was going through the guy's head.
Yeah. And I mean, at the time he gets into his glove box to get that gun, Butcher's setting down Huey to come at him, right? Like,
and he bent over and revealed his own gun on his person. So
I think the guy knows that shit's about to pop off. He needs some protection here, and he has it in his glove box.
Yeah. But, you know, statistically, you're at a pretty high risk of having your own gun used against you when you try to brandish it in a prevention of crime. I don't know if I don't think it's more likely, but it's a statistically significant number. So yeah, there we go. We've gone beyond the pale, and we've questioned this poor suburban dad and his right to bear arms and the trouble it got him into. That's all the feedback we have for this week. If there's any other sugarfish blow the door situations that you need to let us know about, please send those in to dhs@baldmove.com and I will happily consider them for next week's podcast. That's it for this episode. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.